Part 5 Chapter 22 The Restoration. On a cold gray morning in February 2012, less than 2 weeks before Putin's re-election, five young women appeared in the ornate, reconstructed church in Moscow that is, to believers, a landmark of the resurrection of the Orthodox faith after its repression by the Soviet state, the Cathedral of Christ the Savior. They mounted the elevated soleas in the front of the church's iconostasis and shed their winter coats to reveal colorful, sleeveless dresses and mismatched leggings. They pulled colorful balaclavas over their faces and began to dance and shout, their arms punching the air and their voices a discordant echo reverberating in the mostly empty church. One of them, Yekaterina Samuchevich, did not manage to slip the strap of her guitar over her shoulder before a guard ushered her off. The other four carried on, their words difficult to understand at times, though a few came through. Virgin Mary, Mother of God, banish Putin, banish Putin. The episode lasted less than a minute. The women, accompanied by a couple of men, hustled out of the church after being stopped by guards. By the end of the evening, a music video appeared online, spliced with material previously filmed in another church in Moscow, this time with lighting, sound, and a background that in the quick cuts could pass for Christ the Savior. It opened with a melodic hymnal chant, but then abruptly shifted to the grinding chords of the hardest punk, punctuated with vulgarities. The lyrics ridiculed the church and its priests as KGB collaborators, as mercantile and corrupted, repressive toward women, bigoted against gays and lesbians. The song was called Punk Prayer, using a liturgical word for a special prayer service in times of national crisis, Maleben. It was the newest protest from a new, amorphous, guerrilla art collective that, inspired by third-wave feminism, the riot girl movement in the United States, and Putin's return to the presidency, called itself Pussy Riot. The women of Pussy Riot, roughly a dozen, though their membership and identities were kept secret, had created the group in the wake of Putin's announcement, joining the wave of dissent that spilled into the streets after the parliamentary election. The group included members of Vina, or War, an art collective that specialized in provocative, politically themed art performances. In one, they filmed five couples having sex in Moscow's Museum of Biology on the eve of Medvedev's election in 2008, mocking the government's appeals to increase birth rates to avert demographic collapse. In another, they painted a giant penis on a drawbridge in Petersburg, which, when raised, faced the big house on Litany Prospect, where Putin had once worked. Putin's imminent return to the Kremlin now focused the group's creative energy squarely on him. Pussy Riot's first furtive performance in public occurred in October 2011, a month after the Rokirovka. They filmed themselves at various locations inside Moscow's metro, at one point atop a worker's scaffold. Their faces covered with colorful balaclavas, they screamed as much as sang a song that alluded to the protests in Cairo that brought down Mubarak and called for the same in Red Square. In January, they performed in Red Square itself, atop the Lobnaya Mesta, a stone platform built in the 16th century and used to read out the Tsar's decrees. This time, eight members of the group performed a song titled Putin Pissed Himself, inspired by the government's palpable fear and confusion in the face of the protests. The song repeated Alexei Navalny's exhortation from the night of the first protest, which they too had joined. Riot in Russia, they sang. We exist. At first, the authorities did not seem to be paying the group much attention. The performers were often detained and questioned, but they were careful to give false names and were usually let go after a few hours. Their videos, though, careered through the virtual world, where Russia's protest movement now had the momentum. The group's protests and even its name, rendered in English because the equivalent expression in Russian would have sounded far more vulgar, perfectly suited the insurrectionary mood that had somehow survived the winter and carried on into the new year and the presidential election season. The Kremlin's foundation seemed to shudder in the face of it. Despite all expectation, there was a glimmer of hope that somehow the protests might forestall Putin's certain re-election in March. "He's a little less buoyant now," Henry Kissinger said, not long after meeting Putin in Moscow in January 2012, as the protests continued. The elder statesman of Realpolitik had met regularly with Putin ever since he came to power. Putin admiringly recalled their first encounter when he picked Kissinger up from the airport in Petersburg in the 1990s, and the older man flattered him by saying, "All decent people get their start in intelligence." Putin considered Kissinger a trusted counselor, one who respected him and Russia's national interests, whatever the changing state of relations with the United States. Kissinger, the old cold warrior who had long advocated deeper cooperation with Russia, reciprocated the admiration. "Putin is not a Stalin who feels obliged to destroy anyone who might potentially, at some future point, disagree with him," he had once said. "Putin is somebody who wants to amass the power needed to accomplish his immediate task." As Putin's re-election campaign began, the immediate task was to somehow contain the street protests. And Kissinger sensed that Putin's resolve, his usually steely assuredness, had waned at least a bit. The Kremlin, still nominally headed by Dmitry Medvedev, initially offered concessions to diffuse the protesters' anger. They included the restoration of the regional elections that Putin had abolished in 2004 and an easing of restrictions on forming new political parties, as well as securing a spot on the presidential ballot. Even the Orthodox Church called on the government to address the grievances of those in the streets. In an interview on state television on the Orthodox Christmas, January 7th, the church's leader, Patriarch Kirill, said that a crackdown on the protesters would be as misguided as the repressions of the Soviet era. It was a startling statement from an institution that had allied itself so closely with the authorities. Other church leaders began to echo similar sympathies, offering to mediate between the government and the protesters. Then, abruptly, the church's tone shifted. Less than a month later, Putin convened the leaders of all the country's faiths, Orthodox, Jewish, Buddhist, Muslim, Roman Catholic, Armenian Catholic, even the Seventh-day Adventists, an evangelical faith that struggled without official recognition or support, at the Danilov Monastery in Moscow. Kirill, acting as host, now lavished praise on Putin, followed by the other clerics, rabbis, lamas, and muftis. Kirill recalled the hardships of the 1990s, before Putin appeared on the scene, comparing the era to the time of troubles at the turn of the 17th century, and to Napoleon's invasion in 1812 and Hitler's in 1941. "What were the 2000s then?" he said. "Through a miracle of God, with the active participation of the country's leadership, we managed to exit this horrible systemic crisis." He then spoke directly to Putin to thank him for the massive role he played in correcting this crooked twist of our history. The church's support for Putin, an ostentatious, if not deeply devout believer, was not surprising. But in a secular nation with a constitution that formally separated church and state, the choreographed display of fealty to Putin at the height of a turbulent election season provoked outrage, including Pussy Riot's protest at Christ the Savior. Rumors swirled that the Kremlin had pressured the Patriarch and the others to appear with Putin. Articles soon appeared in the opposition press recycling old rumors of Kirill's KGB affiliations, his commercial ventures importing tobacco in the 1990s, and his taste for finer luxuries, including a large dacha, a private yacht, and expensive watches. He denied owning the latter until the unartful airbrushing of an official photograph left the reflection of a fancy watch on a glossy tabletop. The church, once heavily repressed, had emerged from the Soviet collapse as one of the most respected institutions in the country, viewed by many of its adherents as an institution above the country's politics. Now Kirill led the faithful directly into an alliance with the state. Just a month after expressing sympathy for the protesters He now complained that their demands were the ear-piercing shrieks of those who valued a Western consumer culture incompatible with Russia's traditions. Kirill's reversal was striking and, to critics, infuriating, but it reflected the emergence of a central narrative for Putin's return. It was a narrative rooted not in nostalgia for Soviet times, but for the more distant Tsarist past, one articulated in the writings of, among others, Ivan Ilyin, the political philosopher Putin had been citing in his speeches since 2005. In the face of mass unrest, Putin portrayed himself not just as the guarantor of the gains achieved since the Soviet era, but also as the leader of the nation in a deeper way. He was the protector of its social and cultural values. In a series of 7 campaign declarations reprinted in leading newspapers, he outlined a new, starkly conservative vision of the country that referred to Russia's civilizational model, one diametrically opposed to the decadent values of the West, represented in large part by those now protesting his rule on the streets. He had chosen a counterattack, and it was strikingly effective. At the height of the protests in December and January, opinion polls suggested that he might not win half the votes, which would force a runoff. But by February, his ratings began to climb again. The Kremlin's media apparatus remained at his service, portraying him as the steady master of a state under siege. His opponents were too feeble or too extreme, aided by the saboteurs within and their masters abroad, bent on destroying the nation. The arrival of a new American ambassador, Michael McFaul, and an ill-timed meeting with opposition leaders on his second day in the embassy became fodder for state television, which portrayed the protests as an alien incursion. The opposition wanted confrontation, Putin would say at the end of the month, even to the point of committing murder. "I know this," he said, alluding to the defense that had first circulated after the deaths of Anna Politkovskaya and Alexander Litvinenko, and using the language he had once used against the rebels in Chechnya. "They are even looking for a sacred victim, someone famous. They will waste him, if you will pardon the expression, and then blame the government." The day before, the state television network Channel One had disclosed weeks-old arrests of 2 suspects in Ukraine who had allegedly been plotting to assassinate Putin, or perhaps other senior officials, by bombing their motorcades in Moscow. As the election approached, the choice facing Russians seemed stark and existential, as it was meant to: Putin or the abyss. As in his previous elections, Putin did not campaign directly, but his official duties increasingly had overtly military themes. In January, on the anniversary of the lifting of the siege of Leningrad, he visited the cemetery where a research organization had established that his brother, Victor, was buried during the war. Days later, he visited the scientists at the Sarov Center, where the world's polonium-210 is made, and vowed to equip 10 new regiments with new missiles capable of striking deep inside Europe. In February, he held his only public rally at Luzhniki on the old Red Army holiday, now rebranded as the Defenders of the Fatherland Day. The state channels reported that 130,000 attended, though the stadium's capacity was only 80,000, and many of those in attendance were government employees, some bussed in from distant cities. All that mattered was the panorama shown over and over on the nation's television screens. Putin strode to the blue-carpeted platform at a midfield, wearing a black parka to ward off a light snow and clutching a microphone. Alone at the center of a sea of flags and banners, he began awkwardly. "Do we love Russia?" he shouted. As he lurched around the stage, a rage seemed to well up within him. He implored the audience not to look overseas, not to run to the left or to the side, and not to betray your homeland, but to be with us, work for Russia, and love her as we do, with our whole hearts. As Kirill had in their meeting, he invoked the Battle of Borodino that had defeated Napoleon on the outskirts of Moscow. he was appealing to the country's hallowed tradition of resistance to foreign invasion. He even quoted the famous poem of Mikhail Lermontov, published on the 25th anniversary of Borodino, in which a colonel calls on his men to make the ultimate sacrifice to defend the fatherland. "Guys, is Moscow not for us? Then we shall die near Moscow as our brothers died. And we promise to die." 2 centuries later, the battle for Russia continued, Putin thundered in conclusion, his taut face wrenched into a grimace. "But victory is in our genes." By the night of March 4th, Putin's victory had been secured, as almost everyone expected. He won 63% of the vote in the first round, less than in his or Medvedev's previous elections, but still a solid majority. Zhuganov, in his fourth run, finished a distant second, as usual, with 17%. To defuse the accusations that marred the parliamentary elections, Putin ordered cameras installed in nearly every polling station in the country. But evidence of fraud, including carousel voting and ballot stuffing, nonetheless cast doubt on the tally. By some estimates, millions of votes padded Putin's total, though even his harshest critics had to acknowledge that he had the support of most Russians. Putin won every region of the country except Moscow, the epicenter of the disgruntled elite, where he still won 47%. In his native Petersburg, where an outburst of political activism had also spread after the December voting, he drew 59%. Putin declared victory in a brief speech in Manege Square, with the towers of the Kremlin as a television-perfect backdrop. A large crowd gathered before a small platform. Many were from outside Moscow, as at his only campaign rally, bust into the heavily secured zone where Putin would appear. These were Putin's people, not the trendy hipstera, the intellectuals and radicals, the rootless cosmopolitans who would drag Russia away from its historic roots and traditions. "We have demonstrated that our people are able to tell one thing from another," Putin said that night after Medvedev introduced him. "The genuine desire to achieve modernity despite the political provocations that have only one goal, to destroy Russia as a nation and usurp power." As he spoke, tears streamed down his face, the first he had shed in public since Anatoly Sobchak's funeral 12 years before. It appeared to be a genuine display of emotion, but the Kremlin later insisted it was just the bitter wind. The election left Putin's opponents dispirited and disoriented. The celebratory mood of the first large protests faded into despair. The protesters were united by a cause, or a variety of them, but not by any strategy for achieving their goals. It became clear that nothing had changed, and perhaps nothing ever would. Except in the most abstract notions of a pluralistic, democratic society, who would step in if there were a Russia without Putin? A protest was planned for Pushkin Square the next evening, less than a mile from the Kremlin. But what now was the point? Instead of the masses who had surged to earlier protests, this time perhaps 20,000 attended. "We overestimated our force," Navalny said that night. By the end of the allotted 2 hours for protest, enough in the authorities' view to release some of the steam, fewer than 2,000 remained in the square where they had gathered. They seemed uncertain whether to heed the calls by Navalny and a more aggressive opposition leader, Sergei Udaltsev, to remain in the streets, even to set up a tent camp the way the Ukrainians had in Kiev in 2004, or the protesters in Cairo had the year before. Instead, the riot police swept through, swinging their truncheons. More than 250 people were arrested, dozens were injured. The streets of Moscow stayed clear. Protests continued in the weeks and months ahead, but with each one the momentum dwindled. Many Russians wanted to end a system that had become so deeply cynical and corrupt, but only a very few, even among Putin's most ardent critics, wanted a revolution, which was what it would take to force a change. At the height of those protests, one of the Kremlin's political strategists, Sergei Markov, had compared the protesters to spoiled children demanding a toy, the Kremlin to a frustrated but firm parent. "It is not correct to go out and buy the child a toy," he said, "but rather to distract him with something else." Back in February, when she arrived at Christ the Savior Cathedral for Pussy Riot's performance, the guitarist Yekaterina Samuchevich sensed that something had gone wrong with their clandestine plan. Men with video cameras were already in the church. The guards reacted so quickly that it seemed they had been expecting their arrival. Yekaterina, Katya to her friends, suspected there had been a leak from one of the cameramen they brought along to record their performance. Or perhaps the FSB had begun monitoring them as their videos went viral through the protest movement. When they left the church, there were also journalists waiting for them outside. She was never certain, but perhaps it was a setup all along. Either way, it was clear that the authorities had taken an interest in their stunts and wanted to put an end to them. The day after the video circulated, the church's spokesman, Archpriest Sevelod Chaplin, denounced it as a mortal sin, a crime against God. Prosecutors promptly announced that they had opened an investigation, and it was only a matter of time before the full force of the state came down on Pussy Riot. On the day before Putin's re-election, the police arrested three women and a man. The following day, two more women were arrested. The police, still unsure of the group's identities, released four of them. But they had found two of the members who had been in the cathedral that day in February, Nadezhda Tolikonikova and Maria Alochina. Katya was arrested 2 weeks later, on March 16th. They were charged not with hooliganism, a petty violation that would normally not warrant more than a fine, but with hooliganism carried out by an organized group motivated by religious hatred, an ominous sign of the intent to make an example of their actions. The indictment that followed accused them of undermining the spiritual foundations, not just of the church, but also of the state. Conviction could mean as many as 7 years in prison. The members of Pussy Riot had wanted to call attention to the communion of church and state, and they were about to learn how right they had been. All three were held without bail, despite the fact that Nadezhda and Maria were both mothers of young children. The arrests and the gravity of the charges provoked new outrage, now infused with dismay over the inability of the protests to do more than tarnish Putin's easy electoral victory. The three women became international celebrities, admired for their defiance of an authoritarian regime. Amnesty International declared them prisoners of conscience, while prominent musicians, Faith No More, Madonna, Pete Townsend, Paul McCartney, championed their cause. In Russia, however, their fate proved to be far more complicated. Their protest divided the already fractured opposition and, with the Kremlin's gleeful connivance, did as much to discredit it in the eyes of the broader public as anything else. Alexei Navalny, viewed warily by liberals for some of his nationalistic views, denounced their detention, but called their stunt idiotic. "I would not like it, to put it mildly, if at the moment I was in church, some crazy girls ran in and began to run around the altar," he wrote on his blog. Instead of provoking a debate over politics, as they had intended, the case fueled the culture war within society in a way that ultimately favored Putin. The church remained one of the most respected institutions in Russia, on a par with the presidency itself. More than 70% of Russians identified themselves as Orthodox, even if many wore their faith lightly, rarely practicing or attending church. The punk prayer backfired. It rallied the faithful to the defense of the church, despite the scandals over its corruption and mercantile behavior. To believe was to be patriotic. To be patriotic was to believe. In April, on the Sunday after Easter, tens of thousands heeded a call by the Patriarch for a special demonstration at Christ the Savior. The crowd swelled to 65,000, according to the official estimates. Even if those numbers were inflated, the demonstration was larger than any of the protests that continued to sputter on after Putin's election victory, Kirill emerged from the church that day in a procession of bishops and priests carrying icons that had been desecrated in Soviet times, including one with bullet holes dating to the 1920s. The attack of persecutors against the faith today could not be compared to Soviet repression, he said, but the liberalism of the West was a threat because it regarded the very fact of blasphemy and sacrilege, of the mockery of shrines, as the lawful manifestation of human freedom, as something that should be defended in modern society. He never mentioned Pussy Riot, but they had been turned into the symbol of a contagion seeping through the borders of Russia. As for the priests who called for forgiveness for the three in prison, and they were some, citing the mercy of Jesus, Kirill called them traitors in cassocks. On the eve of Putin's inauguration on May 7th, the protest leaders planned one more rally, this one authorized to take place in Bolotnaya Square, across the river from the Kremlin, where Medvedev would relinquish the reins of power that were never fully his own. The weather was warm with the onset of spring, which almost certainly swelled the crowds, as had the prosecution of Pussy Riot. So many people thronged the square that the phalanxes of police officers abruptly blocked the entrance, creating a scrum of protesters jammed on the streets. Those outside the blocked perimeter staged a sit-in. Someone even pitched a tent, an ominous sign for the police, who had orders not to allow the kind of encampment seen in the Orange Revolution. For a time, the protest remained peaceful, but when the police began picking off protesters for arrest, it turned into a melee. The crowds began surging to the defense of those arrested, and the police responded by swinging truncheons. Some in the crowd responded by throwing chunks of asphalt. Boris Nemtsov was shouting, "Russia will be free!" from atop a riser when officers led him away. When Navalny was arrested near the stage, he scolded the officer, his invective recorded by a microphone he was wearing for a documentary about the anti-Putin movement. "I will jail you later," he said, spitting out the names of Putin and his business cronies, Arkady Rotenberg and Gennady Timchenko. He vowed they would be on the wanted list when he came to power. By evening, the protest had ended with more than 400 arrests. Dozens were injured, including 29 police officers. They were dutifully interviewed on state television, lying on hospital gurneys, scenes that many believed had been staged. Putin's usually affable press secretary, Dmitry Peskov, a man known to channel his boss's sentiments, expressed disappointment that the police had acted with such restraint. "I would have liked them to act more harshly," he said. The crackdown continued the next day, even though the streets of central Moscow had been cleared of traffic for the inauguration ceremony. Police officers roaming the capital arrested dozens more, many for no apparent reason other than that they were wearing a white ribbon. A squadron of interior troops even raided what had become known as an unofficial headquarters of the opposition movement. It was a French restaurant called Jean-Jacques, the sort of place that had sprung up in Moscow during the years of economic boom and made it seem more like a modern, vibrant European capital full of young, creative Muscovites ordering foreign beers and wines off chalkboard menus. By the end of the day, more than 700 people were detained around Moscow. Scores of young men who haunted places like Jean-Jacques were taken to draft offices for induction into the army, just as they had been warned when the protest first started. "I think this is to show who is boss," said Alek Arlov of Memorial, the human rights organization. "A new czar has come." Putin's inauguration unfolded at midday with the pomp of the others, broadcast to the nation solemnly and ceremoniously, just as before. Only this time, the cameras met Putin at the office of the Prime Minister in the White House, followed him down the carpeted stairs of the main entrance to a waiting Mercedes-Benz. For 6 minutes, an aerial camera followed the procession of police motorcycles escorting Putin's car and two others as it made its way to the Kremlin, where Medvedev waited, having already saluted the honor guard. The motorcade passed through streets that had been emptied not only of traffic, but eerily of people, too. No one watched. No one waved or cheered that sunny morning. No one even dared be outside. In 2000, Putin had taken his first oath of office against a backdrop of economic and political uncertainty and war in Chechnya. His second inauguration, more subdued, took place in the shadow of that war, amid the tightening of political freedoms and the dismantling of Yukos, but also in the midst of an economic revival that had trickled down to more Russians than at any time in the country's history. Medvedev took the oath in 2008, at a time of hope that Russia had overcome its turbulent history and would pass power to a new generation of leaders, soon perhaps to leaders who knew only modern Russia, not the Soviet Union. Now, Putin returned to take the oath a third time, pledging to faithfully serve and protect the country for 6 more years. But he and the country had changed. He had returned to power by dividing the nation, by stoking fear of the enemies within that wanted to seize power and reverse all that had been accomplished since he first swore the oath. He had returned to power because he made himself the only real choice at the ballot. He no longer seemed to be president for all Russia, but only for the Putin majority. For the opposition, it was a bitter pill to swallow. He retraced the long walk through the Grand Kremlin Palace he had taken 12 years before. The defeated candidates were there, though not in the front. So were Mikhail Gorbachev and foreign leaders like Silvio Berlusconi, a friend now whose 3 terms as Prime Minister of Italy nearly matched his longevity, but whose political life had come to an end amid a swirl of inquiries into his finances and sex life. Medvedev spoke first, briefly, saying continuity was essential to Russia's future and, characteristically, as Yeltsin had but Putin had not, acknowledging the shortcomings of his presidency. "We did not succeed in doing everything we hoped, and did not manage to complete everything we planned," he said. Putin appeared grave and unflappable. He was older, his face tightened by cosmetic surgery, his thinning hair having receded further, but at 59 he remained fit and lithe. "I see the whole sense and purpose of my life as being to serve our country and serve our people, whose support gives me the inspiration and help I need," he began. He said the coming years would be crucial in shaping the country Russia would become, a Russia that had, he said, restored its dignity as a great nation and would be the center of gravity for all of Eurasia. "The world has seen a Russia arisen anew." After his brief remarks, he left the dais alone, striding directly past Lyudmila, who stood beside Medvedev's wife, and Patriarch Kirill during the ceremony. She appeared pained at moments. Her disappearance from public life had become the source of speculation, sympathy, and ridicule. Putin stopped 2 paces beyond her, then turned around and returned to her. He leaned over a red rope and brushed her cheek with a kiss, and then departed. If there was any expectation that Putin's third term would herald a softer, less authoritarian approach, it dissipated almost immediately. The authorities launched a sweeping investigation of the melee at Bolotnia, which officials were now describing as a mass riot and even an attempted coup. Criminal charges were brought against 27 people, not the leaders of the protest movement, not radicals, but ordinary people who had joined the protest in the heady desire to have their voices heard. They included students, a freelance journalist, a sales manager, an artist, a subway worker, and the press aide of one of the few opposition lawmakers in the Duma. One wanted activist, Leonid Razvashayev, fled to Ukraine but was arrested there by masked agents and returned to Moscow, where he claimed he had been kidnapped and tortured. The defendants faced years in prison, often based on flimsy evidence from videos and the testimony of injured and aggrieved riot police officers. There were no mass arrests after Putin's inauguration, no great terror against dissidents, but rather a steady, selective accretion of prosecutorial pressure against those who stood against him. The authorities, used the Bolotnaya investigation as a pretext to carry out investigations across the country for years to come, even in cases that had little connection to the melee that day, including one in 2013 against two human rights activists in Orel, hundreds of miles from Moscow. When opposition leaders planned a new rally for June 12th, the holiday that marks Russia's declaration of independence from the Soviet Union in 1990, teams of police investigators swept through Moscow, raiding the apartments of the most prominent leaders of the opposition, including Alexei Navalny, Boris Nemtsov, Ilya Yasin, and Ksenia Sobchak, the television star, socialite, and daughter of Putin's political mentor, a man once heralded as a symbol of Russia's fledgling democracy. Her role in the protests, which were viewed with skepticism by some because of her celebrity, her wealth, and her family connections to the man at the top, underscored the depth of the opposition Putin had faced in certain quarters upon his return to the Kremlin. "I never thought I would say this," a rattled Ksenia Sobchak told a television station after the search of her apartment. "But how good that my father wasn't here to see this." All of the protest leaders were summoned for questioning the next day, despite the holiday, to prevent them from attending the rally. Navalny encouraged the protest virtually, posting sarcastic messages on Twitter even as he was awaiting interrogation. More than 50,000 people showed up, emboldened by the searches and arrests, and the speakers vowed to sustain the momentum. The pressure only intensified, though, and the harassment of the movement's most prominent figures, especially a celebrity like Sobchak, sent a message that not even personal connections to Putin would provide protection for anyone who rose up against him. It was as if a signal had filtered through the ranks of the bureaucracy. The police, prosecutors, and the new deputies of the Duma and Federation Council all now had license to staunch the contagion challenging Putin by any means. Within weeks of his inauguration, the Duma swiftly passed a law increasing fines for attending unauthorized protests from 5,000 rubles to 300,000 rubles, nearly $10,000 at the time, and many times the average monthly salary. The city of Moscow prohibited the display of white ribbons on cars. The Duma passed one law giving the authorities the power to shut down websites, ostensibly for publishing information unsuitable for children, and another prohibiting the dissemination of homosexual propaganda. In July, a new law required organizations that received foreign funding to register as foreign agents, a phrase with haunting echoes of Soviet-era persecutions, and another allowing a maximum prison sentence of 20 years for anyone providing consultative assistance to a foreign organization, deemed to be acting against the state. Questioned by his own Commission on Human Rights about the harshness and broad scope of the legislation, Putin said he would review it personally. He then signed it into law the very same day. It targeted not just overtly political groups, like Golos, but also others like the Environment Watch of the North Caucasus, which was trying to monitor the environmental damage caused by the Olympic construction in Sochi. In October, the Duma expanded the definition of treason so broadly that someone who unwillingly passed state secrets to a foreign state or international organization, even information that was available to the public, could be charged as a traitor. There was no longer even the carefully choreographed illusion of considered debate as the Duma and Federation Council spit out new laws one after another. Slander, which Medvedev had decriminalized, became a crime again, while penalties for it and for libel, especially against government officials, increased. Also criminalized were blasphemy and offending religious feelings, inspired by the women of Pussy Riot. Those who dissented faced retribution. One Duma deputy who had dared to join the protesters was stripped of his immunity and his mandate. Ksenia Sobchak's mother, Ludmila Narusova, was expelled from the seat she had held in the Federation Council for a decade, despite her relationship to Putin. The flurry of legislating blended the harsh measures of an authoritarian crackdown with patriotic and religious appeals. The result was a potent brew, a cultural war born at the heart of Putin's new presidency. The trial of Pussy Riot was the first major battle. It opened on July 30th, the day that Putin signed into law the legislation on libel and internet restrictions. In their opening statements, delivered in a glass enclosure surrounded by guards and a snarling dog, the three young women apologized for causing offense, but insisted theirs was not an expression of religious animosity. Rather, it was a political protest protected by the freedom of speech. It was the core of a defense that no one expected to prevail. The trial was marred by judicial irregularities and the strenuous efforts of prosecuting lawyers to demonstrate the moral damage the brief performance inflicted, even on witnesses who had not been there but had only seen the video. One of the defense lawyers, Violeta Volkova, complained that the defendants had not been allowed to review the evidence against them, since it included hundreds of hours of videos they were not allowed to watch in their detention center. She added that documents for the prosecution had been forged, that she and her colleagues were not once allowed to meet confidentially with their clients, that the defense's expert witnesses had been barred from testifying, that the court simply ignored the defense's objections. There's a sense right now that we're not in 21st century Russia, but in some alternative universe in a fairy tale like Alice in Wonderland, like Alice Through the Looking Glass, Volkova said, belittling the prosecution's claim that a few seconds of protest could shatter the foundations of a church with a millennium of history. And right now, this whole ludicrous reality will disappear and crumble like a house of cards. Theirs was a show trial that echoed those of Stalin's era or Brezhnev's, this time with each twist and statement chronicled on air or in print on the internet. Although prosecutors did their best to portray the three women as ill-educated deviants, they appeared poised and courageous, well-versed in history and religious thought. In their closing statements, they cited the intellectual and moral rebellions of thinkers from Socrates to Jesus, from Dostoevsky, who once faced a mock execution, to Solzhenitsyn. In her closing statement, Maria Alochina compared prison to Russia in miniature, where the people had lost the sense of themselves as anything other than hapless victims at the mercy of the prison's administration. The trial intensified international outrage over the broader authoritarian turn that Putin had taken, and it dogged him whenever he traveled overseas. He made his first public remarks on the case as he visited London during the 2012 Summer Olympics, the last games to be held before those in Sochi. Putin claimed he had not raised the issue with the British Prime Minister, David Cameron, though the Prime Minister's aides said they had in fact discussed it. Putin's misstatements, his disregard for facts, were becoming harder to ignore. "You know, there is nothing good about it," he said, when asked about the trial. "I do not really want to comment, but I think that if these young ladies went to, say, Israel, and desecrated something there, many of you probably know that there are some very strong young men there, they would hardly be able to leave that easy. If they had done the performance in a mosque in the Northern Caucasus," he said, "the police would not have arrested them in time to save them from a crueler fate." Magnanimously, he expressed hope that they would not be judged too harshly, though the question of judgment was never really in doubt. On August 17th, to no one's surprise, the three were convicted, the judge having dismissed the defense that theirs had been a political protest against the state's leaders. The prosecutors had asked for 3 years, but almost certainly Putin's comments influenced the judge's decision to sentence them to only 2 years. Hundreds of the group's supporters had gathered outside the courthouse, while others swept through Moscow, placing colorful balaclavas on statues. The police were prepared and unforgiving. Even before the verdict was read, Garry Kasparov was carried off from an impromptu press conference on the courthouse steps and beaten as the police forced him into a van. Once news of the verdict spread, clashes erupted around the courthouse, with the police arresting dozens. It all played out on state television, fueling the anti-Western sentiment that had become a staple of the Kremlin's counterattack. In her final statement to the court, Nadezhda had bravely cited Solzhenitsyn's paean to the power of the word in his novel The First Circle. "Just like Solzhenitsyn, I believe the word will break through cement," she said. Pussy Riot's case instead had divided and deflated the opposition. The heady enthusiasm of the protests had now been thoroughly stifled, driven back underground or abroad. Pussy Riot became international stars, but the movement that spawned them suffered. The two other performers who had been at the cathedral, identified only as Balaclava and Serafima, fled the country after the verdict. In October, the three women appealed their sentences. Even Dmitry Medvedev, now installed as prime minister, said that while he was sickened by their protest, he believed their continued incarceration was unproductive and unnecessary. They had already been in detention for 7 months by then anyway. Katya had hired a new lawyer, and rather than trying to justify the protest, she argued that her conviction should be reversed because she had not had time to even play the guitar before she was hustled off the Soleaz. Lawyers for the other two argued that comments by Putin and Medvedev had prejudiced the trial, thus justifying a dismissal or retrial. The judge accepted Katya's argument, releasing her on a suspended sentence, while dismissing the appeals of Nadezhda and Maria. Some suspected that Katya had made a separate deal, or perhaps that the Kremlin wanted to show that the judiciary was in fact free to deliberate fairly. Very few believed that Katya had won her appeal on its merits. After her release, Katya retreated from public view. She still met the remaining members of Pussy Riot in Moscow, but they no longer performed. She was certain they remained under surveillance. In a vegetarian cafe in Moscow after her release, she explained that the meaning of their performances had been badly distorted for the Kremlin's political ends, but she also acknowledged that the broader public had not been receptive to the message. The Russian people were not prepared to challenge the system that had slowly taken hold of society. Putin himself was not the villain in the prosecution against them, she believed. He simply represented the face of a conservative and deeply patriarchal society. The villain was the numbing conformity of a system, in culture and in politics, that made any deviation of thought too risky to contemplate. The problem was not that everyone thought that we were innocent, that the charges brought against us were illegal, that Putin alone was bad, making phone calls and issuing demands in the case, Katya explained. The problem was that everyone thought we were guilty.